Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we are bringing you Hans Kaiser and Eric Iverson of the More Information, Inc. They are a Republican polling firm, and they worked on some incredibly exciting races, Senator Collins in the Senate race in Alabama, and some exciting congressional races out west. Eric is coming to us from California, and Hans is here on the East Coast. And as of today, when we are recording this, it is Tuesday, November 24th. It appears that the transition has begun down in Washington. You notice I didn't say concession. The president has not conceded. I am told by people much wiser than me that he's never going to concede. And they say that as if you're an idiot if you ask. But the transition has begun. So things are moving on and the election is over. I guess the counting is over and now the results are over. And so we're finally moving into the next phase. But Hans and Eric, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And so Hans, since I'm on the East Coast and we're recording this in the morning, we'll give Eric time to wake up and have a cup of coffee. We'll start with you and the Susan Collins race. You know, everyone was kind of following that in my unofficial pool, and I was going on the public polls. And you might want to touch on the difference between public polls and private polls. I mean, I know people know the difference, but I'm not sure people actually think about it when they see them. But in my, I have to tell you, Hans, in my pool, when we were doing the U.S. Senate, I had Susan Collins losing. And so I have to confess that. So what a race that you worked on and what a result. So why don't you start with first with the difference between the public polls and the private polls?
Well, I think, you know, this is kind of a new phenomenon, I think, in some ways, and I won't point fingers at anybody, but we saw in this race a number of polls that came out from odd organizations that had never done polls, maybe necessarily some Democrat-leaning organizations paid for by Democrat-leaning groups. There was an idea, I think, among some to create a bandwagon for Susan's opponent to show that Susan was behind. It helped raise money. It might hurt Susan's fundraising. And so I think with some of these polls that came out, there was a conscious effort to present Susan as in trouble and to energize the Democrat base. For instance, there was a group called Victory Geek that put out a poll in last spring, early summer, that showed Susan down by 9 points. The poll was conducted by a group that sells billboards in Illinois. They'd never done a poll before in a U.S. Senate or a congressional race. But this came out, this makes it into the press, and people think Susan Collins is in trouble. And if you look at all the public polls, I don't think any of them, and the Real Clear Politics measurement, any of them showed Susan ahead. But the folks that we talk with, and we couldn't talk with people that were doing independent expenditures in the state on behalf of Susan because legally we're not allowed to talk to them. But you hear things through the grapevine and people, you know things that are closer than the public polls. So I think it's one of the things that's a discredit to polling, perhaps, but more to the prognosticators, is that they're going by a lot of these public polls, some of which are legitimate, some of which try very hard to get the numbers just right, but others that are there not necessarily to tell the public where things are, but to generate a political advantage over an opponent.
Can I stop you there and just ask you a question? So the poll done by the billboard company in Illinois, that seems like it has no credibility. Does that poll, how does the press, or I don't know if Real Clear Politics put that out, how do they even give that, repeat those results?
That's a good question. And our campaign, then the press put them out. It's in the public domain. Now they're, once it's in the public domain, then other people in the press say it's in the public domain and they start using it. And so the campaign had to put a sheet up, a cheat sheet to get, not a cheat sheet, but an information sheet out just explaining where this poll came from.
But we had to do a lot of that. Whether it was in Maine or Montana or even Alabama, there was a constant, you know, constant request from the campaigns. Can you put together an interested parties memo to push back on the crazy numbers we're seeing from a lot of the times it was universities? I mean, whether it was a billboard company or a college professor who'd never done polling before. We battled that several times in Montana, where we had universities, three different universities in Montana putting out polls that looked nothing like our internal surveys. And they were all done by college professors and they were all done by students. And the media treated them as if they they were experienced pollsters and who knew what they were doing. And it was a constant battle because, like Han says, on the one hand, yeah, you can raise money off of a bad poll. On the other hand, you know, you start getting the calls if you're a United States senator from the local county commissioners and your local fundraisers and the people who are doing your grassroots work saying, geez, everybody's depressed after this. And now you have to go and, you know, go mend a bunch of other fences and do some cleanup. And so there's a practical effect. It does have a drag on a campaign when these polls are put out and they're so wildly inaccurate.
And not to ask a stupid question, but just to get it on the record, in a poll, in a situation like that, you're hurting the Republican candidate or the candidates who is behind, correct?
Yeah, that's right. For the most part, yeah. I mean, again, fundraisers kind of like it sometimes. But what you're doing, particularly, I mean, there was one survey that was done in that Daines-Bullock race. I mean, here you got a sitting U.S. senator going against a sitting governor. And Montana State University in Billings put out a survey a couple days before Election Day showing Steve Bullock winning that race by 2 percentage points. He lost by 10.
That's incredible.
They were off by 12%. And
it's
they
incredible.
Put it out a few days before the election.
And I have to say that, you know, the fact that one college professor can do a poll, that's insane. And the fact that it gets, they really, you know, these news organizations have to stick to, you know, pollsters with some qualifications and some track record and people that are in the business full time. I mean, I was telling Hans when we first spoke, you know, you can imagine that if you think Susan Collins is down by 7 points and you're living in Maine, and it's a cold night and the polling place is 20 minutes away, you can clearly imagine being like, she's going to lose anyways. I'm not going. You can definitely see it impacting on the race.
That's exactly. And Emerson College put out a poll the Friday before Election Day showing Susan down by 6 points and she won by 9.
So how does that happen?
Well, part of it is, I think what they've done and I've looked at some of these polls trying to figure out how they could have them so wrong. Their demographics didn't match up with what the electorate looked like. Sometimes it looked better for us the way they had the demographics, but the numbers looked worse for us. And I couldn't figure a lot of this stuff out. It just didn't make any sense from a polling perspective. But the one thing I do notice in a lot of these is they call it a likely voter survey. And I think in 2020, determining what a likely voter was is, you know, how did you do it? I noticed a lot of these polls that you can start in Maine with voter registration because they have voter registration. You know what percentage of the state is a Democrat, what's the part of the state is Republican and what part is independent. And you start from there. But there's also questions like, do you consider yourself, how do you usually vote, Republican, Democrat, or independent? That's a different measurement. That's a more partisan answer than just registration itself. But without starting with registration and you have a 9 or 10 point advantage for Democrats on vote behavior, that's not what Maine looks like. They might have an 8 point or so advantage on registration, but on vote behavior, it's much closer than that. And I think when you try to control your sample by that and think that vote behavior is the same thing as voter registration, you run into trouble there.
Yeah. A couple of other things we saw on, especially these outside group surveys that they didn't pay attention to, was looking at education level. I mean, there was vast differences between how people vote if you are high school educated or less versus college educated. Some of these university surveys, we would look at it, they would have it just completely wrong. You know, half the sample in a rural Western state having a college degree. I mean, it's just not realistic. Those people vote overwhelmingly Democrat. That's one of the ways you can end up kind of screwing up your sample. The other thing to even take a step back farther, and this is kind of what Han's talking about, this likely voter thing. Some of these pollsters weren't even talking to registered voters. They were getting list of adults. They would then ask those adults to self-report whether or not they were registered to vote. A lot of people don't know. Some states, like Oregon with motor voter, everybody's registered to vote, but not everybody's going to actually go vote. But they would ask them to self-report if they were registered to vote, then self-report how likely they were to vote. So they didn't even have vote history on these people. They didn't have ones, twos, threes, fours, four, fours, none of that. I mean, if it were, you know, it's almost malpractice. in some respects. And, you know, if anybody in the private sector were to operate like that, you would not be in business for very long.
Well, and these legitimate media, I mean, look, anybody, you know, Jim O'Brien can do a poll and do a press release, but these media organizations that are repeating these polls as if they're gospel has got to stop. I mean, really, they are acting irresponsible. And as James Baker said in that op-ed, the former Secretary of State for H.W. Bush, you know, it's a method of influencing voter activity and voter suppression. It's a very sophisticated voter suppression method.
I think that's right. And, you know, not to speak too far out of school here on the Collins race, because this was actually published in one newspaper, I think in Maine. But Hans had a survey showing Susan Collins up by 8 points. It wasn't covered in the Real Clear Politics average. It was not covered nationally and met with sort of like a yawn in most of the press circles. I think it was covered, Hans, in maybe one online publication.
Newsweek Online.
Yeah, Newsweek Online. That's it. It didn't make it into any of the polling averages, none of that stuff.
And this was a poll that they released?
Oh, it was in the 538 average, I think. But yes, we released it in July, because that's when the Victory Geek came out showing Susan down by 9. Mm-hmm. There was another one that had her down by 6. And this was early in the summer where Sarah Gideon hadn't really gotten her. Things did tighten. I mean, I'm going to, you know, things in July and August, we got outspent by a lot of money up in Maine. So I'm not going to talk about what happened after that. But on that public, although we did have another survey that we put out in September, but this was all our surveys that we put out did not have Susan behind. But, you know, when we put out a survey in September that had the race tied, Quinnipiac at the same point had Susan down by 12 points. And Quinnipiac has generally over time been a pretty solid, you know, within margins generally. And that one just seems so far out of whack. But again, you're on a campaign. You've got a candidate that's working their tail off, and you think you're close and you're getting where you need to be. And then a survey comes out like that, and it makes people wonder. 12, yeah. Okay, maybe we're not down 12, but can they be off that much? Can they be off 15 or 17 right. points?
You read my mind. That's why I put Susan in the losing column, because I said just that to myself. They may be off, but they're not off that much.
Yeah.
Doug Jones's pollster, very reputable pollster out of California in the Alabama Senate race, about 10 days before the election, released a survey that was then retweeted by James Carville and picked up all over, showing Doug Jones beating Tommy Tuberville by 1 point. During that same time we were in the field, and this poll was also then released, we had him up 15. That's a 16-point difference. He ended up winning by, you know, roughly 19 points or something like that. That's what they were putting out.
Yeah. So as an aside, you mentioned the college-educated voters going overwhelmingly or majority for the Democratic candidates and the not college-educated now going for the majority of the Republican candidate, that this trend is going on across the country. Is that a new trend and will that continue? And is that a big change?
It's something that certainly we've seen, I think, and you know, Hans might have a different take on this, but I've seen it much more pronounced since Trump won in 2016. That gulf seemed to get a bit wider and it became more reliable. And, you know, in 2016, it was kind of a Trump thing. By 18 and 2020, it had become sort of a Republican candidate thing that, you know, the non-college educated voter was going pretty heavily Republican. And the college educated voter, sort of irrespective of gender even, was going fairly heavy Democrat.
Yeah. And I see it. It's really the post-grads. There's a difference between post-grads and college grads. Postgraduate is overwhelmingly, in some of the states I was looking at, overwhelmingly more liberal, more for Democrats than the college grads in some of the places I was looking. I'm not going to say that happens everywhere, but there was certainly a difference there. But that's one area where you've seen a sea change, is that, you know, that non-college educated voter used to be the working man, the blue collar guy, Democrat, union voter, et cetera. And now that's Trump's best audience. It's the Republicans' best audience. So it's really been a sea change. And the other thing is that I think some of these surveys may have missed is America is still a center-right country. And despite the president's, you know, he still came very close in a country that, you know, where his image was underwater, much more so than Joe Biden. And there was a lot of energy against him. So I think there's a lot of good news out there for Republicans, despite what a lot of these polls were predicting going into 2020 elections.
Well, I mean, the fact that the blue collar workers are now shifting to the Republican Party, that is quite a sea change. How do you see the media or polling being handled in the future? Because now we've had two presidential campaigns where the public polls were so far off.
One of the things I think, and, you know, Susan Collins' race notwithstanding, but I think that had similar, you know, they'd spent over $100 million in Maine. And you've got a two congressional district state. They don't have to buy Boston television. It's Portland, Bangor, and Presque Isle television. And you can spend that much money. They started running ads against Susan in, I think, April of 2019 and never went off the air with their negative ads. So you create this kind of, you know, the cancel culture where if you're for somebody, you must be awful. And I'm not saying that necessarily was the case, but I think in Trump, people, the Trump voter may have just been reluctant to say, yeah, I'm for him because they just don't want to hear the noise they're going to get. I don't think when Trump was not on the ballot in 2018, I think you saw, you know, polling kind of everybody said, oh, polling's OK. It's come back. It's kind of telling us where we really are. But and then in 2020, a lot of these things couldn't measure the Trump factor. And I think some of that element is people just reluctant in the information age when everybody it's just overwhelming to just say, I'm not getting involved in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but that doesn't answer, though, why Susan Collins and in Alabama, they were so far off.
No.
Yeah.
So how do you think, and Eric, why don't you answer that and then touch on how do you think it'll be handled in the future? What changes do you think we'll see, if any, with how the media handles polls?
Well, I mean, I would hope that it would start to root out, you know, some of the bad pollsters, some of those firms that were really off, the billboard companies, the college professors who haven't done this before. You would hope that there would be some sense of shame among these media companies who put these polls out, like the Washington Post showing Donald Trump losing by 17 points in Wisconsin, to say, you know, maybe we need to take a look in the mirror and reexamine this, because you know, getting it that bad, even if you're trying to influence the election, is pretty embarrassing. So I would hope that there would be that, although I've not seen that from the media. I mean, they've dove right back into these Georgia surveys, you know, in that runoff race, as if nothing happened there. And so, you know, I think that hopefully it'll weed out some of those bad actors. I think another lesson from this isn't easy. And the way you do it is you have to do this process from a dynamic sort of a process. And what I mean by that is, sure, we all have our set of controls and we know, you know, for instance, you know, 18% of this electorate should be 18 to 34 year old and 52% should be women. And, you know, 31% should come from this specific, you know, media market and all those things that, you know, we put into our surveys in order to get them accurate. And I think that you can do that when you have 4, 5, 6, 7 surveys in an area. And you begin to have a track record and you can say, wait a second, in this survey here, you know, why are we getting so many more college educated people into the survey versus non-college educated? But if you're just doing a one-off and you're airdropping into Maine and you've never polled there before and you do one survey and come out, there's a real good chance you're going to get it wrong. So I think, you know, part of it is these media companies should do a series, like over the course of the campaign cycle, do 4, 5, or 6 of them. They don't have to be long, lengthy surveys, but just so you begin to have a track record to see if the assumptions that you made at the beginning of the election year, meaning the turnout model and who's going to turn out and vote, are actually holding up. Because sometimes, as Hans knows, you got to fine tune that stuff throughout the election cycle. And you have to say, look, some of these turnout assumptions that we thought were going to happen in February, you know, we're 4 or 5 polls in and it's now August. There's things we have to tweak here. And you're missing that if you're just kind of doing a one-off survey into a state and you have no real experience there.
It would seem to me that if you were any kind of organization publishing polls, that particularly for the pollsters like Quinnipiac, that above all else, you'd want to get it right. You'd want to say after Election Day, I said Susan Collins was going to win by 4 points and she won by 4 points. It would seem to me that that's what you would want. Hans, I was going to ask you what, so $100 million, what did that come out? That's incredible.
Well, I think it was more than that. The campaign alone, the Sarah Gideon campaign alone raised more than $70 million. And but then you have the third, you know, all these third party groups, whether it's the Democrats. I mean, don't get me wrong. The Republicans had third party groups, too, in Maine. And finally, in September and October, we were able or getting into October, we were able to match her up on TV and the same amount of TV basically for Susan.
What do you think they spent per voter, per vote?
I don't know. I think that, and Eric may know these numbers better, but that was Montana was the most expensive per vote. Maine was the next expensive per vote.
There was $160 million spent in that Montana United States Senate race. And this is a state that's only got, you know, a little under 1.1 million people. You know, you had basically 760 some thousand people vote in this, and you know, 160 million. And it got to the point where there wasn't even, you know, you talk to the ad makers out here, they couldn't buy inventory. It was gone.
Yeah. I mean, you run out of things to do.
There's no place to stash money. Yeah. I mean,
that is just a mind-boggling amount of money. I mean, mind-boggling. I remember Linda McMahon self-funded and challenged now Senator Chris Murphy, well, and Senator Blumenthal, actually.
We worked with her on the Blumenthal race.
And she spent, what, $50 million?
Yep, on both of them.
And at the time, and still, I mean, there's 3 million people in Connecticut. It's an incredible amount of money. And you're talking about in Montana spending $160, $170 million, and they have a third the number of people as in Connecticut. And you spent three times as much money. It's almost hard to do. So what are you hearing or seeing about the two Georgia Senate races?
I mean, it looks to me like they are sort of beginning where they ended. And that, you know, that shows Perdue up by a couple of points. And the Loeffler race, essentially a jump ball, a tie right now. What I think is different this time around, particularly in Loeffler's case, is, you know, Warnock, her opponent was not litigated very well during the general election. This runoff now, it gives all of the groups, the Republican aligned groups, the chance to really and go and define him. And I think voters are learning stuff about him that they didn't know before. They're recycling all the stuff on her, but on the Democrat, there's a lot of new stuff that's being learned. And I think that's probably going to be enough to get her across the finish line. And I think Perdue will probably end up winning that, you know, sort of where he ended off on election day, which is, you know, margin of error, sort of a victory.
I think there's an element here that hasn't really come into play yet. And I think the numbers don't reflect that yet. And that is, when we get closer to January 5th and people are actually voting, the fact that it's going to be Joe Biden in the White House, that it's no more about no more legal avenues for the president. Okay, you're going to have Biden in the White House, Pelosi in the House. Are you going to give the Chuck Schumer the Senate so the Democrats can do whatever they want, or do you want a check and balance? And the American people generally, over our history, have wanted to keep a check and balance. That's why in off-year elections, the party out of power generally does better. It's not happen all the time, but for the most part, it really does. And it's kind of an unspoken, I don't know if people even would vocalize it, but that's the way elections come out. And I think when it's clear that the Biden is going to be taking the oath of office on January 20th and running the country, and Nancy Pelosi still in the House, that's going to have a lot of impact on people wondering which way to go on this and on the turnout model. Because if you've already got the White House, you're less energized, you're less angry than to turn out and vote than if you've lost and you want to make sure or you want to voice your disaffection. And so I think that's not out there yet, but I think it's coming.
Interesting point. As the dust settles, you think it'll help the Republican candidates. And that makes sense. You know, in the election we just had, you didn't know who was going to be president. You might have assumed that the Democrats were going to get the Senate because that's what all the polls indicated. Once the dust settles, you know you're going to have a Democratic president. You know you're going to have a Democratic House, and you could have a Republican Senate. Very interesting point. All right, let's head out. Oh, actually, one more question, Hans, for you on Senator Collins. What is it like dealing with the candidate and the campaign when they're seeing all these polls saying they're getting killed and your internal polls are obviously different? You must get a lot of phone calls like, are you sure you're right? Tell us about, and not necessarily, I'm not asking you to disclose your conversation with Senator Collins, but describe what it's like to get those phone calls from candidates and campaigns.
You know, we've worked with Susan for 24 since her first election, 1996, and we've developed the team and we've all worked together and we all kind of know the state, and we know that what we do when we poll is how you poll in Maine, and we know the audience we're looking at. And so they, you know, the campaign takes that, with that knowledge, it reassures them.
But Hans, you must still get the phone call though. Come on, they must get a little. I mean, look at she's a human being. The manager's a human being. If I'm reading, I've worked with you on five campaigns, and I know you're good, and I know you're right. And every morning I pick up the news, and I'm losing. What do you do when they call and they're like, Hans? Are you sure you're pulling? Are you staying on top of this? How do you manage those phone calls?
I would say that in the Collins race, that really wasn't a problem. I mean, sure, they were – the concern in the Collins race was that this would affect fundraising. This would affect the outcome of the race because it's creating this dynamic, this get on board because the train's pulling out of the station dynamic that Susan was going to lose, so you got to be on. That was more of our concern than whether the numbers were right or wrong. And we talked about that. And so those kinds of calls are more like, how do we discredit this? But when you've got poll after poll after poll that doesn't match up, yeah, it becomes a little depressing. But when you have trust in you with your clients and that you've worked with them for a long time, that goes a long way. And it certainly does. They had faith in us, and I'm glad they did. But in general, you say stick to the numbers. I always tell clients when they see a poll and it doesn't look like what our poll has done, you don't know why this poll is being put out. You don't know the methodology. You don't know what a likely voter is, how they're making it up. You don't know how they weighted the data. Don't base any decisions on these public polls, you know, other than what we have to do to respond to them. But internally, where we are in the race and what we need to do, that should come from our own numbers because we know exactly how they were collected and we know exactly how they were weighted and what that it's a representative sample of what we're going to be looking at on election day. So that's really the advice I give to clients is you don't know how they put this together. You don't know the reason for it, but you do know in a lot of cases the reason for it being put out. But it's, you know, the interesting thing I'll say one more thing about Maine is the Gideon folks, our opponents, and they have good pollsters. They didn't put out a single poll during the entire campaign. Now, you might say, well, they didn't have to. But my guess is that they had numbers that looked a lot closer to ours than the public polls. And they did, there was no reason for them to get out publicly.
That's a very interesting, very, very interesting point.
We saw the same thing in Montana. You know, Bullock's campaign never put out a single survey. That's where we were surprised when you talk about Alabama and Doug Jones putting out a survey showing him up 1 when we had Tuberville up 15. And we did get that call because, you know, Coach had never run a race before. And, you know, some of the questions from the campaign were, how in the heck can we have a 16-point difference here? This is a prominent firm. They got Joe Trippi working for them, you know, prominent, you know, Democrats, Carville and all those guys are working on that campaign. How can they be this wrong? And we actually, you know, one of our smart math people in our Portland office was able to reverse engineer the Democrat survey and figure out how, because like Hans said, we don't know how they weighted it. We didn't know their demographics. But what we're able to determine is how you get to a, you know, a tied race down there in Alabama is they were assuming turnout in 2020 general election was going to look like the 2017 special election when Doug Jones beat Roy Moore. Now, you can make that assumption, but it was nuts, right?
Like, that's crazy.
Freaking nuts.
That is
so
crazy.
That's how they did it. And, you know, we're able to reverse engineer that one and tell the client, well, listen, if your theory of the race is that this is the same electorate as in 2017, okay, the race might be tied. We think it's going to be a presidential election year turnout with straight ticket voting in Alabama that's going to go heavy Trump, heavy Tuberville. You're going to win this thing easily.
Yeah, people turn out for Trump, not Roy Moore.
Right.
Well, I think, Hans, I think it also helps if you have a candidate who clearly has a steel spine. So that's helpful. Well, let's hope the media, for the most part, kind of corrects itself and going forward. But I think you just gave our audience a very great piece of advice or insight. And maybe for obviously for all the pollsters, it's stating the obvious, but for a lot of us, it's very interesting. You know, watch when you're seeing polls, whether or not the campaigns are putting out their numbers, because if they're not, it may be telling you something. That's a very interesting point about the Gideon campaign in Maine. Let's head out west now. Eric has had time to have his coffee and is hopefully waking up. He's clearly awake. He's been engaged here. Eric, you have had, you flipped a couple of congressional races out there. Why don't you tell us about one of those?
Yeah. You know, probably the biggest one we're looking at is in California 21, where former Congressman David Valadao, you know, at least, you know, some of the, you know, the DC prognosticators, AP has not called the race yet. But Cook has. It looks like Valadao has beaten incumbent T.J. Cox, winning back the seat that he had held in Congress, lost in 2018. And this is a really interesting district. I mean, it's 56% Hispanic. It's double-digit Democrat registration advantage. Presidential election year, Joe Biden, you know, winning that district easily, and you had a Republican take that seat back. I mean, it's significant. Not easy to do. We saw it also in Utah 4, where Burgess Owens defeated Ben McAdams in a Salt Lake area, sort of a suburban type of district. The district that, again, the experts said there's no way Republicans were going to win these. And yet we were able to help flip that seat as well, working on independent expenditures in that seat. And then we worked for Valadao in California 21. Those are, you know, a couple of really big flips in difficult districts for Republicans. And, you know, I mean, I think if I would have told you on election day that Republicans were going to flip 12 House seats, maintain control of the United States Senate, and Donald Trump would lose, you would probably thought I was crazy. And then you throw into the mix some of these ballot measures in California where, you know, again, in an election year where Trump ends up, you know, looking like he's lost this thing, California voters did not reverse their ban on affirmative action. They rejected attempts for cities to, you know, expand rent control measures. They rejected increased property taxes. They supported property tax reductions. I mean, you know, California voters doing, you know, the Uber and the Lyft ballot initiative there, where they didn't force Uber drivers and Uber and Lyft to treat those independent contractors as employees. I mean, Callie, Han said it earlier, you know, America is still a center-right country. California voters, when you look at a lot, most of these ballot initiatives, the big ones, they voted center-right, you know, in a state that Republicans routinely lose statewide double digits. So, you know, there were a lot of underlying good news for Republicans. I mean, top of the ticket, that was our big bad news, but a lot of underlying really good news for Republicans coming out of 2020.
Bad news for the final outcome for the top of the ticket, but good news in the amount of turnout for the top of the ticket. And that's really kind of what carried us.
8 million more votes, right?
Yeah. And if you look at the electorate as a whole, the electorate, you know, from and you think about the white vote. Well, if you go back to, 2004, whites represented 77% of the electorate. And now it's down to 67% whites representing in the electorate. But back then, you know, 34% said they were conservatives. I mean, we now, 45% said they were moderates. You're now in this electorate in 2020. 38% said they were conservative, 38% said they were moderate, and 24% said they were liberal. So you've got an increase in the non-white vote. You would think it's the electorate's becoming less conservative, but the non-white vote is not necessarily liberal or moderate. It can be conservative as well. So as Republicans look down the road to less of a white electorate, there is also a conservative electorate, and it's not changing that dynamic. And I think that's something that we can, that looks promising for us. But I think the president drew out a lot of those people, and Republicans are going to have a challenge in 2022, probably not as much because it's an off-year election and that we'll be energized as a party because we're out of power. But 2024 for the next, unless the president comes back and runs again, energizing those same people that Trump pulled out of the woodwork for the last two presidential elections is a big challenge for Republicans.
Yeah, as you say, there's been a lot of talk about that shy Trump vote. And looking at some of the data that, you know, from races that we worked on, I'm not so sure that it's a shy Trump vote as much as it was a shy conservative vote. And what Hans is talking about there, that expansion of the amount of people who are calling themselves conservative that we've seen in a lot of states and nationally, a decrease in the amount of people saying moderates and a decrease in the amount of people saying liberals. When I looked at data, you know, you're in a race where you're doing 6, 7, 8, 9 polls over the course of time. And we always ask the philosophy question. When you would see that philosophy come in and you had too many liberals and not enough conservatives than what you had had maybe over the last 6 or 7, that was impacting the ballot. And again, it goes back to something we talked about earlier. You know, I would hope that some of these public polls would do more surveys throughout the course of an election cycle, because that's how you can see anomalies. We looked at those and we said, well, listen, here's why the Republican candidate now appears to be down, whereas 10 days ago they were up, because the amount of conservatives in our sample went from 45 to 31 and liberals went from 17 to 29. So, you know, you have to be able to make some of those fine-tuned adjustments. And so you could look at that and say, well, it's a shy Trump voter. Not necessarily. They were there last week and they answered the phones. They answered the phones a week before. Sometimes you get those glitches. And so I think a lot of it was just conservatives in general on some of these surveys were being missed and not accounted for. And assuming that, well, you know, because they're, you know, in California 21, for example, where 56% of the vote's Hispanic, that they all must be liberals, is a very faulty and dangerous assumption to make.
And why are Republicans doing better with the Hispanic vote? Is your data telling you anything?
I'll tell you what issue worked well. Talk about socialism, things of that nature. you know, when you're talking about, you know, folks whose family background can be from areas of the parts of the world where socialism reigned and socialism was the dominant force,
such as Venezuela or Cuba.
And all of a sudden, they're hearing talk of their elected officials pushing ideas and ideologies that they left, or at least generations ago of their families have left. That made a big difference. The Democrat overreach and assuming that because you are a voter of color, that therefore you must be at the extreme left fringe ideologically was a mistake that Democrats made. I think it was a mistake in their polling, and I think it was a mistake in their strategy.
Those 12 seats that they flipped in the House, how did Trump do in those districts?
In California 21, for example, we were talking about that, the one you brought up earlier, Trump lost. It's not tallied, but he's going to lose that district. So you have, like Maine, you have Republicans sort of out kicking the coverage, doing better. I think Trump ended up losing Maine by 9%. Susan won it by 9%. You know, Valadao is going to probably win that race by 1,000 votes, and Trump's going to have lost that race. You know, I don't know if it'll get to double digits. California isn't reporting presidential election results by congressional district, but it's looking like, you know, Trump's going to lose, you know, outside the margin of error rather handily. And so that phenomenon was not uncommon in certain places of the country. I mean, look, you look in Georgia. I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, Republicans at the end of the day winning those races that the president ended up losing. And so that happened around the country. And it does go back to, you know, I think that, you know, is it divided government that Hans talked about? Yep, I think that's part of it. I think some of it was personality driven with the president. And that's how somebody like Susan Collins, who over the years has created a brand for herself, and that can withstand national headwinds if you do that. And that's one of the real lessons for those running for office or those in elected office currently who want to be able to weather this kind of storms that can happen is, you know, the Susan Collins model is just do a good job. Good policy ends up being good politics and create a brand for yourself and you can weather these storms.
I agree. And that's in a smaller sense, but nonetheless true. David Valadao was like that from his time in Congress. He was a get things done kind of guy, grassroots. He knew people. He'd get out there. He speaks fluent Spanish and people knew him there. And that's what helped him do a lot better than Trump in that particular district.
Well, guys, this has been great. It was great to have you on and have this discussion and give our listeners kind of an inside view of working on these campaigns and these races. For our listeners out there, remember, you can find us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can also sign up for our Monday morning email at thepoliticallife.net. It comes out every Monday morning along with the show. There'll be in the show notes, you'll be able to find information on Hans and Eric, their LinkedIn profiles, and on More Information, Inc. And we hope you all continue to stay safe and stay healthy, and you have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.